Chapter 5. In the morning, the taxi dropped them at the base of one of the ceiling-penetrating towers, a faceted pineapple with neon snakes coiling up its flanks. In the smoke-coloured lobby, a queue for the elevators had already formed. Serious-looking young people milled around, several of whom were evidently well-known to Sunday and Jitendra. Hands were pumped, knuckles touched, high fives made, whispered confidences exchanged. They were speaking Swahili, Russian, Arabic, Chinese, Punjabi, English. Some were multilingual, others were making do with earphone translators, usually ornamented with lights and jewelry or just enthusiastic gesturing. The air crackled with rivalry and the potential for swift backstabbing. Jeffrey hadn't sensed anything like it since his last academic conference. "It's a big deal for Jitendra," Sunday explained. "Only two or three tournaments a year matter as much as this one. Reason everyone's come out of the woodwork." She gave her partner a playful punch. "Nerves kicking in yet, Mr. Gupta?"
"If they weren't, there'd be something badly wrong with me."
Jitendra was working his fingers, his forearm muscles tensing and relaxing in a machine-like rhythm. He jogged frantically on the spot until their elevator arrived.
"But I'm not afraid."
The elevator shot them up through the core of the building, through the ceiling, through meters of compacted lunar soil, onto the night-drenched surface. They exited in a small, glass-sided pimple, the embarkation lounge for bubble-canopied rovers, docked like suckling piglets around the building's perimeter. In all directions, 100 or so meters apart, the ground was pierced by the uppermost sections of the other structures, glowing with lights and symbols, spilling reds and blues and greens across the wheel-furrowed ground. A couple of suited figures trudged between parked vehicles, carrying suitcase-sized toolkits. Other than that, there was a striking absence of visible human activity.
"Is this where it all happens?" he asked.
"Way to go yet, brother," Sunday said. Before very long, they were aboard one of the rovers, gliding away from the embarkation structure. The rover had six huge openwork wheels, the powdery soil sifting through them in constant grey cataracts. As the rover traversed a boulder, the wheels deformed to ensure the transit was as smooth as possible. The driver, and there was a driver, not just a machine, clearly took a gleeful delight in heading directly for the worst of these obstacles. She was sitting up front, hands on joysticks, dreadlocked scalp nodding to private music. Soon, the buildings receded to a clot of coloured lights, and not long after, they fell over the horizon. Now, the only illumination came from the moving glow of the rover's canopy and the very occasional vehicle passing in the other direction.
"I thought I'd be picking up full org signals by now," Jeffrey said.
With the bubble canopy packed to capacity, the three of them were strap-hanging. His org icon still showed a broken globe. "You're still in the zone," Sunday said. "Think of it as a tongue sticking out, with a little microzone at one end of it. There's no mech here, just our stripped-down private org. Even if the surveilled world could reach us here, we'd put in our own jamming systems." In the absence of airglow, it came as a surprise to summit a slight rise and suddenly be overlooking an amphitheater of blazing light. A kilometer-wide crater repurposed as arena, with pressurized galleries sunk back into its inner wall. Spherical hooded viewing pods resembled so many goggling eyeballs, linked by the fatty optic nerves of umbilical connecting tunnels. The rover passed through an excavated cleft in the crater wall, then drove around the perimeter. Jeffrey pushed to the window. Huge machines littered the ground, beached by some vast Selenian tide. Worms, or maggots, or centipedes, segmented with plates of deftly interlocking body armor, and ranks of powerful tractor limbs running down the lengths of their submarine-sized bodies. They had chewing mouths, drilling proboscises, fierce grappling and ripping devices. The ghosts of sprayed-on emblems survived here and there, almost worn away by abrasion where the machines had rolled over on their sides or scuffed against each other. Vivid, silvery scars, not yet tarnished by the chemical changes caused by cosmic ray strikes, betokened fresh injury. The machines, lying around the perimeter, were being worked on, readied for combat. Service gantries and cherry pickers had been rolled up, and suited figures were repairing damage or effecting subtle design embellishments with vacuum welding gear. There must have been at least 20 machines, and that wasn't counting those located further into the arena, lying side by side, or bent around each other, mostly in pairs. Jeffrey presumed this was a lull between bouts, since nothing much appeared to be happening.
"I'm guessing these machines weren't originally made for your fun and games," he said to Jitendra.
"Heavy-duty mining and tunneling equipment," Jitendra said. "Too beat up or slow for the big companies to keep using, so they sell it off to us for little more than scrap value."
Jeffrey laughed.
"And this is the most productive thing you could think of doing with them."
"It's a damn sight better than staging real wars," Sunday said.
"This is mine," Jitendra said, as they drove past one of the waiting combatants. "Or rather, I have a quarter stake in it, and I get to drive it when my turn comes around."
If anything, it looked a little more battle-scarred than its neighbors, with chunks nibbled out of its side plating, exposing a vile gristle of hydraulics, control ducting, and power cables. Plexus's nerve node emblem was faint on the machine's side.
"She's taken a few hits," Jitendra explained superfluously.
"Do you get inside it?"
"Fuck no!" Jitendra stared at Jeffrey as if he'd lost his mind. "For a start, these things are dirty. They're running nuclear reactors from the Stone Age. Also, there's no room inside them. Also, it's incredibly dangerous being inside one robot while another robot is trying to smash yours to pieces."
"I suppose it would be," Jeffrey said.
"So, when does it all start?"
Jitendra looked at him askance.
"I beg your pardon?"
"I mean, when does the fighting begin?"
"It already has, brother," Sunday said. "They're fighting now. Out there. At this very moment."
When the rover docked, they took him up into one of the private viewing pods. It contained a bar and a semicircle of normal seats, grouped around 8 cockpits. Partially enclosed chairs, big and bulky as ejector seats, their pale green frames plastered with advertising decals and peeling warning stickers. 5 people were already strapped in with transcranial stimulation helmets lowered over their skulls.
"Jeffrey," Sunday said, "I'd like you to meet June Wing. June, this is my brother up from Africa."
"Pleased to meet you, Jeffrey."
June Wing was a demure Chinese woman in a floor-length black skirt and maroon business jacket over a pearl blouse with a silver clasp at the neck. Her grey-white hair was neatly combed and pinned, her expression grave. The look, Jeffrey concluded, was too disciplinarian to be unintentional. She wanted to project authoritarian firmness. They shook hands. Her flesh was cold and rubbery. Another golem, then. Although whether it was fixed form or claybot was impossible to determine.
"We sponsor Jitendra's team," June said.
"I can't normally find time to make it to the tournament, but today's an exception. I see you're here in the flesh. How's your trip been so far?"
"Very enjoyable," Jeffrey said, which was not entirely a lie.
"Sunday told me you're working on elephant cognition. What are your objectives?"
Jeffrey blinked at the directness of June Wing's interrogation.
"Well, there are a number of different avenues.
The pursuit of knowledge for its own sake or towards some practical goal?"
"Both, I hope."
"I've just pulled up your pubs list. Considering you work alone in what might be considered a less than fashionable area, you have a reasonable impact factor."
"Reasonable?" Jeffrey thought it was a lot better than reasonable.
"Perhaps you should come and work for Plexus," June Wing said.
"Well, you have obligations back home."
"Yes. We're very interested in minds, Jeffrey. Not just in the studying of mental processes, but in the deeper mysteries. What does another mind think? What does it feel? When I think of the color red, does my perception tally with yours? When we claim to be feeling happy or sad, are we really experiencing the same emotions?"
"The qualia problem."
"We think it's tractable. Direct mind-to-mind process correlation. A cognitive gate. Wouldn't that be something?"
"It would," he admitted. Jun Wing clearly had more than a passing understanding of his work, or had deduced the thrust of it from a cursory review of his publications list. He was inclined to believe the latter, but with that came an unsettling implication. He must be talking to one of the cleverest people he'd ever met. How would it feel to be in the same room as her, not just a robot copy? Well, you know how to reach me if ever you decide to broaden your horizons. First time at Robot Wars?
Yes. Doesn't seem to be much going on, though. Is it always like this?
He felt even more certain of this now. Across the arena, the pairs of machines hadn't moved to any obvious degree since he had seen them from the rover. Only one of the operators is actually driving a robot now, Jun Wing said. The other four are spectating or helping with the power-up tests on one of the backup machines. The rival operators, our competitors, are in the other viewing pods.
But nothing's happening.
They're tunnel boring machines, Chitendra said. They're built to gnaw through lunar bedrock, not set land speed records.
Even as he spoke, Jitendra was lowering himself into one of the vacant cockpits. He reached up and tugged the transcranial stimulator down, nestling it onto his skull.
We can't speed up the bots, he went on, but we can slow ourselves down. Even your best civilian implants don't mess with the brain at a level deep enough to upset the perception of time, so we need some extra assistance. Hence direct stimulation of the basal cortex, that and some slightly naughty deep-level neurochemical intervention.
As always, I'll pretend I didn't hear that, Jun Wing said.
Jitendra slipped his wrists into heavy medical cuffs attached to the frame of the chair. They'd throw a fit in the surveilled world, but, of course, we're not in the surveilled world now. And that doesn't preclude outside sponsorship or external spectators. There's money to be earned, reputations to be made and lost.
I guess the Plexus sponsorship helps, Jeffrey said. It's not just advertising, Jun Wing said. There is some actual R&D going on here. The robots have human drivers, but they also have their own onboard battle minds, constantly trying to find a decisive strategy, a goal-winning solution they can offer to the pilot.
Okay, here it comes, Jitendra said, closing his eyes. Slowdown's beginning to take hold. Wish me...
He stalled between words. Luck. And then he was out, as lifelessly inert as the other drivers, not unconscious but decelerated into the awesomely slow sensorium of the robot out in the arena.
He's driving her now, Sunday said, pointing to the robot Jitendra was controlling.
You can just see the movement if you compare the ground shadow against the one from the support gantry.
What do you do when you want some real excitement? Race slugs against each other?
Life moves pretty quickly if you are a slug, Jun Wing admonished. It's just a question of perceptual reference frames. She gestured to one of the vacant cockpits. Jeffrey can spectate if he wishes. I have a reserved slot, but I'll pass for today.
I'm carrying some fairly specialized org hardware, Jeffrey said, meaning the equipment he needed to link to Matilda.
Nothing will be damaged, brother, I promise you, Sunday said.
And if it is, my own labs will soon put it right, Jun Wing said, with breezy indifference to his concerns. So jump right in. Jeffrey was still wary, but another part of him wanted to get as much out of his lunar experience as possible.
You need to take a leak? Sunday asked. You're going to be in that thing for at least 6 hours.
Jeffrey consulted his bladder. I'll cope. I didn't drink too much coffee this morning. Sunday helped him into the vacant cockpit.
The cuffs will be analyzing your blood, any signs of stress above and beyond normal competition levels, and the system will yank you out. Same for the transcranial stim. It's read-write. There's not much that can go wrong.
Not much.
Sunday cocked her head to one side, appearing to think for a moment.
Well, there was that one guy.
She lowered the transcranial helmet, adjusting it carefully into position. You were doing this at competition level, we'd cut back those curls and get the probe closer to your skin, but you'll be fine for spectating.
Org status messages flashed into his visual field, informing him that an external agent was affecting his neural function. The implants offered to resist the intrusion. He evoked them into acquiescence.
So, what happened to that one guy?
Nothing much, Sunday said breezily. Just that being in the cockpit permanently reset his internal clock. Even after they withdrew the stim and the drugs, he was stuck on arena time.
How's he doing now?
Thing is, he hasn't got back to us on that one yet.
The cuffs dropped their painless fangs into his skin. Two cold touches, neurochemicals sluicing in, and he felt himself sliding, tobogganing down an ever-steepening slope. He made to grab onto the sides of the cockpit for support, but his arms, even his fingers, felt sheathed in granite. Then the rushing sensation ebbed, and he felt perfectly still, amniotically calm. Something had failed, he decided.
All right, Sunday said. What you're hearing now is me slowed down into your perceptual frame. You've already been in the cockpit for 20 minutes.
I don't believe you, Jeffrey said.
Make that 21. June and I are off to the bar now. Be back in a second or two. We'll begin piping direct imagery into your head. Enjoy the show.
He was almost ready not to believe her, but the digits in his tourist visa were whirring at super fast speed. Jeffrey's perceptions took a savage lurch and he was suddenly out there, disembodied, able to roam at will in the Ching space of the arena. Jitendra's robot wasn't crawling now. It was propelling itself in convulsive jerks, tractor claws threshing, body sections pistoning back and forth like some heavy industrial mechanism that had escaped its shackles. Lunar soil, disturbed by the robot's passage, collapsed back into itself as if composed of molten lead under Jupiter's immense gravity. Around the arena's perimeter, a frenzy of blurred motion attended the waiting machines. Elsewhere, dual combatants were locked in titanic wrestling matches, writhing and thrashing to the death. Jitendra's opponent crossed the graded soil like a demented iron maggot. It differed from Jitendra's robot in its details, but was of comparable size, equipped with a broadly similar range of offensive devices. On its flanks, in luminous red, shone the Escher Triangle logo of MetaPresence, Plexus's main competitor in Ching facilitation and proxy robotics. The nerve node emblem on Jitendra's machine was now similarly bright and unfaded, painted over the image by the org. Accompanying these overlays were a host of statistics and technical readouts, speculating at the likely efficacies of armor, weapons, and combat tactics. The two robots halted at the laser-scribed circle of combat. Articulating two-thirds of the way down their bodies, they had been designed to steer during tunnel-boring operations, the robots reared up and bowed to each other. Agonizing minutes must have passed in real time as this martial ritual was observed. The engagement was as sudden and brutal as a pair of sumo wrestlers charging into each other. At first, Jitendra's machine appeared to have the upper hand. It flexed itself around the enemy, using rows of tractor limbs to gain purchase, sinking their sharpened tips into gaps in armor plating. Articulating its head end, it brought the whirring nightmare of its circular cutting teeth into play. As they contacted its opponent's alloy head, molten metal fountained away on neon-bright parabolas. Reflecting Jitendra's initial success and the changing spread patterns of bets, the statistics shifted violently in his favor. It didn't last. Even as Jitendra's robot was chewing into it, the other robot had retaliatory ambitions. Halfway down its body, armored panels hinged open like pupil wings, allowing complex cutting machinery to scissor out. Servo-driven vacuum cutters began to burn into the belly of Jitendra's robot, clamped into place with traction claws. A kind of peristaltic wave surged up the body of the assaulted machine, as if it was experiencing actual pain. It relinquished its hold, bending its body away, disengaging the whirling vortex of its cutting teeth. The stats updated. Pink vapor jetted at arterial speed from the wound that had been cut into the side of Jitendra's robot. Some kind of nuclear coolant or hydraulic fluid, bleeding into space. The two machines rolled away from each other. The enemy retracted its cutter, the body armor folding back into place.
Jitendra's machine staunched its blood loss. Stalemate ensued for objective seconds before the resumption of combat. The enemy twisted its head assembly and locked on with clutching mouthparts, horrible, girder-thick, barbed mechanisms. It was chewing, drilling, tunneling into Jitendra's robot, metal and machine bits spraying away from the cutting head. From the rear of the enemy machine, from its iron anus, a grey plume of processed matter emerged. It was chewing, eating, digesting, defecating, all in mere seconds. Jitendra's stats were now dismal and falling. But he wasn't finished. The enemy bit into something it couldn't process as easily as Moonrock, some high-pressure jugular. Bad for Jitendra, even worse for the machine trying to eat him for dinner. The enemy jolted, regurgitating a large quantity of chewed-up machine parts. Mouth mechanisms spasmed and flopped as a wave of damage ripped through its guts. Jitendra's machine twisted sharply out of reach. It had been bitten into around the neckline, but its whirling drills were still racing. It reared up like a striking cobra and hammered down on the enemy. Machine parts skittered away in all directions, cratering the arena. Now it was time for Jitendra's machine to spring out additional grasping and cutting devices, hull plates popping open like frigate gun doors. Jitendra's stats rallied. But this wasn't going to be a victory for either machine. The enemy was wounded, perhaps fatally, but so was Jitendra's charge. Its drill parts were not turning as furiously as they had been only a few moments before, and its entire body was sagging, no longer able to support itself off the ground, even against the feeble pull of the moon's gravity. When the end came, it did so with startling suddenness. Jitendra's machine simply dropped dead as if it had been pulled to the ground by invisible wires. For a moment, the enemy machine made a valiant attempt to regain the advantage, but it was in vain. It too had suffered catastrophic systems failures. Like a deflating balloon, it collapsed to the ground and fell into pathetic, corpse-like stillness. In a flash, recovery teams arrived. Tractors shot out from silos. Tiny figures, frantic space-suited Lilliputians, swarmed out of the tractors and bound the fallen monsters in drag harnesses, cobwebbing them from head to tail with comical speed. The figures buzzed around and then vanished into the tractors again, as if they'd been sucked back inside. The tractors lugged the dead machines to the arena's perimeter, gouging runway-sized skid marks in the soil. That was the end of the bout. Jeffrey knew, because he was being pulled back into real time. He felt the chemicals metabolizing out of his bloodstream. The visor digits slowed their tumble. The transcranial stim was over, the helmet rising back away from his head.
"Well?"
Sunday asked, standing over his reclining form.
"What did you think?"
For a moment, his mouth wouldn't work. "How long was I under?" he managed.
4.5 hours. June's gone back to work.
If she was lying, then so was the visa. I guess everyone says the same thing. It didn't feel like it.
"That was a short bout as they go. 7-8 hours isn't unusual,"
Sunday answered, pushing a drink into his hand.
12-13, even that wouldn't be out of the ordinary.
His neck had developed an unpleasant crick. Jitendra, who was being hauled from his cockpit, had the wiped-out, dehydrated look of a racing car driver. Friends and associates were already mobbing him, patting his back and making sympathetic bad show faces.
"I'm sorry," Jeffrey said, teetering over to Jitendra. "I thought it was going your way for a while there. Not that I'm an expert or anything."
"I lost my concentration," Jitendra said, shaking his head. "Should have switched to a different attack plan when I had the window. Still, it's not all bad news. A draw gives me enough points to retain my ranking, whereas they needed a win not to go down the toilet."
He worked his shoulders as if both his arms had popped out of their sockets and needed to be relocated.
"I don't think the damage is as bad as it looked out there."
"Nothing that can't be welded back together," Sunday said.
"One good thing came out of it," Jitendra said, before burying his face in a warm, wet towel.
"Which was?" Sunday asked.
"It... 15-17. He gave them both a grin. I figured that bit out anyway, and I was right. Those numbers do mean something to me.
When they were back at the apartment, Sunday and her brother prepared a simple meal, and they shared another bottle of wine, one which Jeffrey had insisted on buying by way of celebration for a successful day. They dined with Tumani Diabate providing kora accompaniment. The recording was 100 years old, made when the revered musician was a very elderly man, yet it remained as bright and dazzling as sun glints on water. When the dishes had been cleared and the wine glasses refilled, she knew that the time had come to invoke the construct. This was the crux, she felt certain. If Eunice could offer no guidance on the matter, then all they had was a dirty glove and some cheap plastic jewels. And with the possibility of mystery safely banished from their lives, they could all return to their mundane concerns. Good evening, Sunday, Eunice said, speaking Swahili. Good evening, Jitendra. Good evening, Jeffrey. Good evening, Eunice, they chorused. How are you enjoying your stay? Eunice asked, pointedly directing her question at Jeffrey.
Very much, thank you, he said, but with an edge of nervousness, as if he did not quite trust that Eunice's working memory had been scrubbed after their last exchange. Sunday and Jitendra are first-rate hosts.
Excellent. I trust that the remainder of your visit would be just as enjoyable.
She turned her imperious regard onto Sunday.
May I be of assistance?
We have a question, Sunday said.
If it's about the glove, I'm afraid I've told you all I'm able to.
It's not exactly about the glove. Well, it sort of is, but we have something different to ask you now.
Sunday looked at Jitendra, inviting him to speak. I discovered a pattern, Jitendra said. 3 numbers. They relate to Pythagoras.
Where was this pattern?
Eunice queried sharply, as if addressing a small boy who had mumbled something out of turn in class.
There were gemstones in the glove, Jitendra said. Red, green, and blue ones. The numbers form a Pythagorean triple. 8, 15, 17.
I see.
It took me a while to make the connection, Jitendra went on. It was almost there. I couldn't quite bring it out. Then I saw the MetaPresence logo on the side of the other robot, the triangle. And it was like a key turning in my head. It wasn't a Pythagorean triangle, of course, but it was enough.
Question is, why Pythagoras?
Sunday asked.
Could mean several things, but seeing as we're on the moon, and seeing as there's a good chance that glove came from a moon suit, I wondered if it might have something to do with Pythagoras itself.
She swallowed and added,
as in the crater on the Earth-facing side.
Eunice cogitated for many agonizing seconds, her expression perfectly unchanging. Sunday had taken pains to imbue the construct with Eunice's own speech patterns and mannerisms, and this kind of hiatus was one of them.
Something did happen to me there, she said, breaking her own silence. Systems failure coming into land at the Chinese station in Anaximenes. Lost thrust authority and hard-landed in Pythagoras.
She smacked her fist into her palm, making a loud, meaty clap. Ship was toast, but I managed to suit up and bail out before she lost hull pressure. Chinese knew where I'd come down. Problem was, their one rover was out on an excursion, and if I sat tight waiting for them to get a rescue party to me, I'd be toast as well. My only option was to walk, and to try to meet them 2/3 of the way. On the other side of the crater wall. So that's what I did. I walked, actually hopped most of the way, and climbed, and I was down to 3 hours of useful consumables when I saw their rover cresting the horizon. She shrugged, profoundly unimpressed by her own story. It was a close thing, but there were close things all the time in those days.
So that's it?
Sunday said doubtfully.
That's all that ever happened to you in Pythagoras?
If you would rather I hadn't made it, dear child, then I can only apologize.
Now, I didn't mean to downplay what happened, Sunday said. It's just, well, another Eunice story. In any other life, it would be the most amazing thing, but in yours, it's not even a chapter, just an anecdote.
I have had my share of adventure, Eunice conceded.
When did this happen? Jitendra asked.
The year would have been...
Eunice made a show of remembering.
59, I believe. Back when Jonathan and I were still married. It was a different moon then, of course. Still a wilderness in many respects. A lot changed in the next 2 or 3 decades. That was why we decided to move on again.
To Mars, with the Indians, Sunday said. But even Mars wasn't enough of a wilderness to keep you happy.
Living out the rest of his life there suited Jonathan, didn't suit me. I came back to the moon eventually, but only when the rest of the system had exhausted its ability to astonish.
I'm surprised you didn't come all the way back to Africa, Jeffrey said.
And cripple myself under a G of gravity again? I'd barely set foot on Earth in 40 years, boy. I missed the household. I missed the acacia trees and the sunsets. But I did not miss the crash of all that dumb matter under my feet, pinning me to the earth under a sky that felt like a heavy blanket on a warm night.
She jabbed a finger against the side of her head.
Space changed me. I could never go home again. Space will do that to you.
If that bothers you, best stay home. Excuse me for having an opinion, Jeffrey said. She eyed him, then nodded once. Eunice had always placed a much higher premium on those who had dared to stand up to the monstrous force of her personality than those who gave in without a fight.
I should not blame you for living later than I did, Eunice said, adopting a tone that was as close to conciliatory as she ever got. You did not choose to be born in this century any more than I chose to be born in mine.
And that was a long time ago, Jitendra said.
You think so? The construct replied. There are rocks out there still sitting on the lunar surface that haven't moved since the late heavy bombardment.
She might be right, Sunday said.
If Eunice crashed somewhere out of the way, like Pythagoras, then there's a good chance her tracks are still there, from the landing site all the way out of the crater to wherever the Chinese rescued her.
Just so long as Pythagoras hasn't been chewed over for water or helium, Jitendra said, or had casinos blasted all over it.
The Chinese station at Anaximenes was a supply point for their hydroxyl mining and refining operations around the North Pole, Eunice said, tapping her instantaneous knowledge base. Once the pipelines were in and extraction became automated, there was no need to keep all the crude stations open. There's no longer a human presence in Anaximenes, and the last person to set foot in Pythagoras was me. She paused, catching herself before anyone else had a chance to speak. Actually, I lie. A recovery team flew in to strip the ship for anything salvageable. Tronics, fuel, shielding. They were Indian, and under space law, they had the right to fillet the wreck. But that was only a few weeks later, and they wouldn't have touched most of the evidence.
Evidence, Jeffrey said. It's like we're already talking about a crime scene.
Maybe we're making a bit too much of it, Sunday said. If the glove was meant to lead us to the crater, why didn't it just come with a handy little map tucked into it? A test of your ability to draw the necessary conclusion from the clues, perhaps, Eunice suggested.
Well, good luck, Jeffrey said. I'll be deeply interested to hear what, if anything, you find out there.
We're all in this together, brother, Sunday said.
Speak for yourself. All I've done is examine a glove at the request of the family. Sunday turned back to the construct.
Thank you for your time, Eunice. You've been most helpful.
It's over, Jeffrey said when the figment had vanished. There's no mystery, no reason to come clean about the glove and the gemstones. Sunday shrugged and decided, possibly with the assistance of mild intoxication, that she would call his bluff.
Fine. Call the cousins. Tell them what you found.
They still think the glove's in Copetown.
Say you went back and got it. It'll only be a white lie.
Jitendra sucked air through his teeth. Beginning to wish I hadn't been so clever after all.
It's all right, Sunday said. This is just a brother and sister thing.
What Sunday doesn't grasp,
Jeffrey said, is that there's more at stake to me personally than the reputation of Eunice or the family business. You think you're the only one with responsibilities? I have to put the elephants first, and that means keeping the cousins happy, so I'll take the glove back to Earth and declare the contents to customs.
Sunday said nothing. She knew when her brother still had more to get off his chest.
But I won't tell the cousins about the mathematical pattern. They can work that out for themselves, if they're bright enough. And I won't tell them what Eunice just told us either.
They're not fools, Sunday said. It's a compromise. You and Jitendra can keep digging into this little treasure hunt if you wish. The cousins don't need to know about that. Mainly they'll be relieved that there wasn't anything obvious and incriminating in the vault. Now they can go back to their polo with a clear conscience.
At least we agree on one thing, Sunday said. Neither of us likes the cousins very much.
They're Akinians, Jeffrey said. I think that says it all.